Hi, this is Dave Brock, President and CEO of Partners in Excellence. Thanks for joining us on this podcast today. I'm really excited to have as my guest, a fellow tweetaholic, I think, and somebody I look up to and admire and consider a great friend, Vala Avshar. Vala is CMO of Enterasys. And Vala, welcome.
Good morning, David. Thank you very much for your kind introduction.
Well, you've made Twitter easy for me because I just retweet probably 90% of what you tweet. So you have such great content and great ideas.
I appreciate that.
Vala, before we get on, if maybe for our audience, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and Enterasys, and also about the book. I mean, one of the things that I want everybody to do is go out and buy Social Business Excellence. It's really a fantastic book, and we'll not do it justice in this conversation, but we'll give people a peek into what you're talking about.
No, I absolutely appreciate your endorsement of the book and my work. As you said, my name is Vala Avshar. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer and the Chief Customer Officer for Enterasys. I'm responsible for both marketing and customer service and support. Enterasys is a 30-year-old company. We're about 1,000 employees, and we're in the business of developing and delivering enterprise networking solutions. This is a company that's been growing for the last 3.5 years. We have a very loyal customer base. Our company net promoter score is 80. I'm very proud that in 2012, both the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe named us one of the best places to work, which is something that myself and the rest of the employees at Enterasys are very proud of. And we're a social business, which is really the, in my view, the essence of the customer centricity and mindset that we have here at Enterasys.
And I think that's a really great place for us to start. And I think it's something, the concept of a social business is something that a lot of people really don't understand, and frankly, they get scared about, they're wondering, does everything go on Facebook? Is it all Twitter? Does everybody start blogging? But, what really is a social business, Vala?
David, that's a great question, and you're right. There's a misconception in terms of equating a social enterprise or a social business with one that uses Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and social networks. And certainly use of technology helps scale your voice and your accessibility to your customers, partners, and employees. But in my view, social is a mindset. Social transformation in business is as much a philosophical transformation as it is a technological one. It's an ecosystem where you have shared accountability and you've made a conscious decision to shift from a command and control method of managing the business and the traditional hierarchical ecosystems that exist to one that embraces collaboration and co-creation of value. It's making yourself accessible. It's communicating your purpose. I love the TED Talk by Simon Sinek where he said, we all know what we do. Some of us know how we do it, but only a few of us know why we do what we do. And in a social business, you lead with the why, because it's hard to collaborate, and collaboration can be messy. Collaboration can test your ego. Collaboration requires hard work and effort and humility. But, unless you can focus on the why and have a common purpose that's meaningful to the individuals inside the business, it becomes difficult to become a social collaborative environment.
Well, you've got so much for me to kind of follow up with you on. You know, first, you know, one of the things that I really like about what you've said is social business is not about technology. You know, and I think too many of us with, you know, the onslaught of social media and things like that, you know, tend to think social business is all about technology and our use of technology. You guys make great use of technology in supporting your social business. But the way you described a social business is it's a sense of values and behaviors and really a culture within the organization. And then you leverage the technology to support your being social.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, as a technology company, as a technologist, certainly you have to be aware of the mega trends that influence not only your customers' buying decisions, but your own company structure and procurement practices. No question that we live in a highly mobile. You know, there are projections that there's going to be 1 billion smartphones sold this year alone. It took 8 years for the first 1 billion smartphones, and we're going to double that just in 1 year. We live in a social era. Twitter alone is the fastest growing social network in the world. There's 714% increase in active Twitter users since July of 2009 to present day. A recent Forbes article talked to just the massive growth of just Twitter and networks, social networks that didn't exist 2 years ago, like Pinterest, have grown where 15% of online users today now use Pinterest. So we live in a mobile, social, cloud, data-driven environment, and things are more complex every day in terms of, and your customers and partners are more savvy. So you can't ignore the technology element in the equation. But the success factor in business will continue to be, in my view, and order matters here, culture, people, process, and lastly, technology.
Yeah, and so it kind of goes in that order, and I think too often we tend to, you know, frankly, forget the first three and focus on the technology, and that's why I think we have so many failures. Let me, you know, this whole issue of, you know, culture, you know, kind of setting the framework first within the organization and then with your organization and everybody and your customers is really messy and tough stuff. You know, and it's kind of that soft stuff that we don't like to talk too much about. Tell me a little bit about what, you know, in Terasys, I know you and the entire executive team spend a huge amount of time kind of focusing on this, creating a value system, demonstrating those values in your personal behavior. Tell me how you build that kind of and reinforce that internal culture, how you leverage this messy thing you called collaboration to really get people working together rather than in silos and all that kind of stuff.
You know, we started by defining our North Star, you know, a guiding principle and our core values around, you know, and we call it North Star rather than a mission statement. You know, we think about, you know, in the olden days, you know, when you had sailors and, you know, the market is the wind and you can't control the wind. It's never a straight line. But as long as you can, you know, navigate using your North Star, hopefully you can reach your destination. And for us, the North Star was there's nothing more important than our customers. There's nothing more important than our customers. But the way we defined a customer was anytime someone is relying on you to deliver a service, they're your customer. So in a business, you have a lot of internal customers. As a service organization, when I have to deliver a software correction to my customer when they contact our call centers, and I now engage with engineering to help me provide that solution, that resolution, I am a customer to my engineering organization. And unless they have an optimistic, accountable view and a sense of urgency to making sure that they're delighting me, the service organization, I would not be able to in turn delight our external paying customer who's waiting in this scenario for a particular resolution or or an optimization. So our culture was based on a high degree of transparency, because for you to demonstrate accountability, you have to have a culture of measuring results, but then have the guts, the courage to share those results, and feel that you're part of a safe environment. Indifference is awfully quiet, and sometimes people confuse loyalty with silence. They think just because you don't have noisy employees or complaints that there's a degree of loyalty that exists, and that may not be true. So you have to feel that it's okay to have calculated risks in the business and feel comfortable engaging. But you started the conversation with, it is tough building a culture. And in my simple definition of culture is, what happens when the manager leaves the room? In the absence of authority, what happens? And so this is why the people element is so important. And in our business, we have a top grade mentality. And when I say a top grading mentality, if an employee demonstrates that they're drifting from our culture, regardless of their talent, regardless of their skill, if they don't believe the core values and guiding principles and our North Star, and they demonstrate the love, and they fail to demonstrate the lack of accountability and transparency and collaboration that we want in the business, they won't be part of Team Interesis. And those are the tough decisions that leaders need to make to ensure. And that's why, when we look at hiring individuals in our service organization, or frankly, any customer facing part of our business, we hire for attitude and then train for aptitude. It's in this hyper connected knowledge sharing world that we live in, the employee is the brand. And the collective personality of all the employees ultimately define your culture. And so it's really important that you have this focus on making sure that there's alignment with the core values and guiding principles of the business.
Well, and that's it's something that I encounter so much of the time. It's in fact, earlier this week, I was with an organization and talking to the management team, and they had one particular very, very, an extraordinarily high performer. It was a sales guy that just year in and year out, whatever target you set, he beat it and just did tremendously. But, internally, there was a lot of broken glass. He just didn't fit into the culture. He created a lot of animosity around him and his peers and kind of in the support infrastructure and so on. And he really exhibited a whole bunch of destructive behaviors. And, we'd gone through looking at, can we coach and develop this person and so on. And it turned out the person just was uncoachable and unwilling to change. And we reached this point where, you said, you have to terminate the guy. Regardless of how great the performance is, what we discovered was the adverse impact he was having on everybody else's performance was just sucking the whole organization down. And it's, I see too many executives that, they deal with that high performer, and what they do is they focus on the hole that high performer might create by terminating them, but they neglect the havoc that person is creating in the performance impact that person is creating on the rest of the organization. And I've always seen that, however big their individual contribution, it's tiny in comparison to poisoning the rest of the organization.
Right. Yeah. It's part of the benefits, and perhaps in some might view the downside of a social business is that the degree of transparency that it exists. One, there's nowhere for mediocrity to hide. So if you're not performing, it's very clear. You do have to have a listening and learning and mentoring culture to be able to successfully transform a business where, again, it's safe to make mistakes and learn from it. It's safe to be innovative. I think that I personally believe that, you know, too much efficiency can kill innovation. And you have to give, you know, ideas need, you know, room to grow. And there's the level of nurturing and feeding and caring. So we do have a mentoring, coaching philosophy and mindset at Interasys. But at the same time, you know, we absolutely, and I absolutely agree with you, the team chemistry is more important than any individual accomplishment. And if you have destructive behavior, and it is very tough in this scenario you just mentioned, somebody who is consistently producing in sales and meeting their number and their target and delivering the promises that they've made to the business, those are hard, talented employees to come by. But, you know, as you define your individual traits and communication traits and management traits of the business, if there's misalignment there, there's a greater impact. So a social business is still a business. You still have to make tough decisions. Business metrics like revenue and EBITDA and gross margin and all those, you know, they don't go away.
Yeah. Well, and also, I know you're just a tremendous basketball and football fan, having sat in your office and seen the trophies and posters and all and jerseys around, you know, but it's kind of like if you look at, you know, the really great teams aren't the teams where there's a single outstanding star that takes, you know, does everything. The really great performing teams are the ones that act as a team, and they may have some superstars, but they all work together and collaborate. Absolutely. And interact for the good of the team, not for individual recognition or whatever. Let me ask, I'd like to, in just a moment, kind of shift to how do you extend this kind of culture and this environment to embrace the customer? But before I do, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, I imagine in kind of the atmosphere that you set and the culture you set, there's, you know, a lot of potential conflict and contention. How do you manage and how do you positively embrace conflict and contention within the organization?
You know, I think that it goes back to involving the employees to help you define, you know, the organizational goals. As an example, and you mentioned, you know, my involvement in terms of being a fan of sports and athletics, and certainly, you know, we have the Celtics and the Patriots as a customer. So not only I'm a fan, but I serve these great institutions as well. And when you think about accountability, I mean, sports to me is a perfect example of the highest level of accountability because, you know, as an athlete on the field, as you're playing the game, there's a scoreboard, and the fans and the teammates and your competitors, they all have a real-time visibility of how you're contributing towards the win or towards the loss, whether you're rebounding, scoring, passing for assists, or fouling out of the game and making turnovers and so on and so forth. So when we decided in our service organization years ago to create a scorecard for our employees to measure their performance, we adopted a balanced performance scorecard that looked at various key performance indicators. And when we started the process, it was a 100% collaborative process whereby we asked every single individual that was part of our service and support organization to define a Hall of Fame, an all-star, a starter, a bench, or a minor league level performance in our call center and services business. And together, collectively, we defined what a Hall of Fame service and support professional would look like. And across about 8, 9, 10 different KPIs, key performance indicators, we set thresholds. And we made sure that once we had this balanced performance scorecard, every one of our employees can log on to the web and they can see exactly at any given time where they are performing compared to the group average and the group best. So benchmarking individual performance compared to the peers within the organization. And once we had consensus, once we as a team, and when I say team, I mean from entry-level contributors in our business all the way to myself, once we all agreed on the key performance indicators and the thresholds, there was no animosity in terms of communicating our group performance and where the individuals were performing across these KPIs. So, you know, it comes to a very simple equation. No involvement equals no commitment. As long as you involve the stakeholders, and transparency isn't about sharing everything. Transparency is simply sharing the logic behind the decisions you're making. And once you have agreement in terms of destination and direction, it's then just a matter of how fast can you get there. So it's important to just involve the stakeholders along the way, and then be flexible enough to course correct. You know, we don't have all the answers, and all the data we have is, this is Clay Christensen, all the data we have is from the past. To be successful in the future, you need to develop theories, and all we're doing is developing theories. But we have to be able to adjust the theories as we go along.
But I think also it goes back to something you said earlier about silence and you know, in the kind of culture you create with both the visibility, the alignment and visibility of metrics and things like that. But silence can't really exist. So, you know, you have people justifiably, you know, engaging with each other, talking and so on. And so much of what I see in other organizations is you go to lots of meetings and you see a lot of kind of passive aggressive behavior. People are kind of nodding their heads, not really contributing. Right. And then they go out and do what they wanted to do anyway. So it's hard to get alignment and hard to go forward. So let me shift.
Go ahead. No, I think that's the advantage of being having leadership with a social mindset, is that, you know, you leave the office and you meet with the individuals one-on-one. You can't just rely on team environment. Even if you have a collaborative, healthy environment, you know, you have a group of introverts and extroverts, and sometimes, you know, the dominant personality can manipulate or not manipulate, but dominate the time in a meeting. And so it is important to spend the time and have one-on-one, have breakfast, have lunch, take your peers and your subordinates and spend some quality, alone time and get a sense of, you know, their thoughts and how the organization is progressing forward.
Super. Let me shift a little bit. How do you extend this ecosystem to embracing the customer? And you said some really important words kind of at the very beginning of this discussion of, you know, around collaboration, around co-creation. And I would also imagine, you know, around kind of shared accountability and shared values with your customers. So how do you extend this and create real customer centricity and collaboration with your actual real customers?
Sure. Well, I'll give you one tactical example. Today, when Enterasys customers log on to the web to submit technical inquiries to our call centers through the web self-service portal that we have developed for our customers and partners, you know, not only they can submit cases, but they can receive case updates and have visibility in terms of how we're managing their open tickets. But there's a button in this self-service portal that they can push, and then within a few seconds, they have a 12-month summary report of all their contact into our call centers. And we catalog the 12-month contact profile by the type of contact. Was it a consultative service? Was it a software defect? Was it a hardware defect? We map all the contact by the products that they have. You know, we have a very large portfolio of products, switching products, routing products, wireless products, security. So we map the contact into the different product families. We share the customer survey scores that they gave us. We list the customers who contacted us by name. I mean, we have large enterprise customers where we have maybe 10, 11 different engineers from the customer side contacting us through our 12-month period. And so it's a very comprehensive executive summary report of a 12-month contact history, which means that the customer has as much visibility as I do. They're, you know, I've invited the customer in the kitchen, and they're watching me prepare the food. There's absolutely no piece of data that I have in terms of their contact history that's unique to my view that they don't have accessibility to within seconds. Now, when you're willing to share product and service quality information to a customer or partner, that's a sign of transparency and commitment you have of making sure that the customer has enough access to the data to ensure that they're comfortable making a decision going with Enterasys. And all companies that we compete with have the technological capabilities in our CRM solutions to deliver this type of capability. And if they're not, it's because they have a philosophical barrier that they have to overcome. And that being, are you willing to share product and service quality data to your customers within seconds? Because, frankly, if you have your sales team going into that customer account and they're pitching a new solution, are you willing to potentially jeopardize that sales opportunity knowing that the CIO at your customer site can pull up a report right before the meeting and question whether there's product quality deficiencies or service quality deficiencies? And so here's a tactical example of really inviting your customer to ensure that, you know, there's that level of transparency to ensure mutual trust. Absolutely, absolutely. And it's funny. So I present at a lot of customer service and support consortiums and events, and the number one question I get is, you know, and of course we provide this report to our sales organization as well, is, you know, do you have a team? Does this type of report inundate your management in terms of having to explain product quality trends, service quality trends, and so on and so forth? And, you know, ultimately, if you're delivering strong product quality, strong service, no. It's just, in fact, it does the opposite. I've had CIOs tell me that this report helped them justify our maintenance renewals, whereby they can go to the CFO and say, look, this is proof how much we rely on Enterasys service and support to help run our business. Because, for example, we contacted them 1,000 times in the last 12 months, and most of it was consultative service on how to best use our technology and solutions. But again, it takes a certain degree of courage and a mindset to be able to deliver this type of service to your customer.
But well, in reality, though, I mean, it's just plain common sense. I mean, you can't kind of sweep these things under the rug and hide them because everybody knows them anyway. So, you know, let's right. get them out in front and have everybody know that we're addressing them. Have everybody aligned around that and move forward right. in the relationship, not just try and mask things that all of us subconsciously say. There is one thing you said that we never have talked about before, but I thought was amazing and potentially subtle, but you mentioned in the report you talk about profiling kind of each individual in an organization that may have contacted you, and I think that's really kind of remarkable. I think too often as we talk about customers internally, we tend to think about customers as enterprises, but they're really collections of people who work for an enterprise, and we lose that kind of personal connection. And, you know, the fact that your report identifies people individually, it becomes valid that I'm at Enterasys that I'm talking about, not Enterasys. Or it's Dave at Partners in Excellence, not the enterprise. Yeah. And it changes the character of how you think about things and how you approach things. And it really humanizes it. You know, it puts a real face to the customer, not a logo to the customer, but a face to the customer. And it, in my experience, really profoundly changes your behaviors in that interaction.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Humanizing the business is exactly the biggest benefit that you get from social social transformation. And when you think about a tool like Twitter as an example, you know, yesterday I had an opportunity to meet with the chief digital officer at Harvard University. Her and I met through Twitter. It's amazing the level of filters that are removed when you're engaged through social networks, because most of these executives, you know, and I'm fortunate enough to speak with executives such as yourself and other Fortune 1000 CIOs and CMOs through Twitter. And these are folks that have administrators, and typically to be, you know, to have an opportunity to engage with them and talk about technology or process or market trends, you know, you have to set up an appointment, you got to do X, Y, and Z, go through a bunch of email chain. And now, you know, it's, you can in less than 140 characters start a conversation with these amazing thought leaders. And that same concept exists in servicing your customer and being a social enterprise. And over time, good business is personal. And customers build relationships, not with my switches and routers, as much as I would love for them to hug my router and switch. They build relationships with my frontline employees and with myself and my peers. So humanizing the business is critically important. And I think that's one advantage that a small, mid-sized enterprise like Enterasys has when we compete against some of the giants that we do compete with, in that, you know, if you're not accessible, you're not social. And my customers can talk to me, tweet me, email me, get me on the phone, because myself and the other executives at Enterasys are highly accessible. And I've been told on a number of occasions, in fact, we had a executive briefing meeting yesterday where a customer said one of the reasons why we love the partnership with Enterasys is that I know I can talk to the CMO anytime I want. You know, as long as you're not on the road, as long as it's, you know, we're in the same general time zone, I can talk to you about your roadmap and I can talk to you about service and support. And I don't get that same level of access with some of the other companies. And so I do think that there's a massive advantage of humanizing your business by becoming a more accessible, more collaborative, more social business.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just some of the kind of, even they seem subtle, but some of the things that you've done and kind of the systems and the reporting and all that to humanize the business are phenomenal. Several years ago, I was involved with an organization that was really losing the customer connection, and we did something really simple, but we went out and took pictures of their customers, not the logos, but we took pictures of the people, and we put little stories in, you know, in the long hallway leading to the cafeteria. We had hundreds of pictures and hundreds of stories, and all of a sudden, you know, every day as people were going for their coffee or lunch or whatever it was, you know, they started seeing who the customer was, and it wasn't a bunch of big logos, but it was a bunch of people, all of whom had a story. And, you know, all of a sudden, in just kind of very subtle ways, it started changing behaviors and attitudes that I'm not dealing with a big corporation. I'm dealing with a person who, and each person has their own story and what they're trying to do. And how do I connect effectively with that person? And now technology has made it so much more, one, visible and transparent, and so much more easy for us to reach out and have that connection.
Right. That's a brilliant story.
Oh, go ahead. You've been awfully generous with your time. If, you know, for the audience that's trying to figure out how do I take this and what do I do next, what are the top three things that you would recommend of really starting to change to achieve that level of internal collaboration and then external collaboration and transparency with the customer?
That's a great question. I think, you know, start with a meaningful purpose. Start with a meaningful purpose. Be mindful of the user experience. You know, define, as you're defining your processes, think like a customer. You know, a lean process, one that has few layers. You know, the execution velocity ultimately is the biggest factor in terms of establishing customer loyalty. The faster you can meet their needs, the more likely that they will be loyal and committed to your to your brand and your solutions. Involve executives. You know, you can't have a social business transformation unless the most senior team is committed to communicating and really fostering a collaborative environment. And it doesn't have to be the marketing guy or the services guy. You know, find the true champion, true change agent, and maybe the CEO, or maybe whomever, maybe the CFO. But, you know, somebody who is represents the executive team that can help, you know, sponsor and make sure that there's enough budget, enough time allocated to the initiative. I know that we at Enterasys had lunch and learn sessions where we sponsored events where employees could learn about social collaboration tools and the benefits and you know, why it was important to our business. You know, an individual can start a movement, but for momentum to be sustained, the community has to own the cause. So you have to be building a community. This isn't a one man, this isn't a one group effort. It has to be a community, and it has to have cross-functional representation. You can't, you know, you're not a social business if it's only the marketing department is collaborating and social. It has to include engineering, supply chain. So it's important to have the patience and the effort of this. And then maintain a positive, you know, pragmatic, optimistic view of the whole thing. You know, honestly, you have to be likable. You have to default to yes. Any sort of cynicism, any sort of negativity can really destroy momentum. And is it? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the difference between cynicism and critical thinking. It's okay to ask good questions. I think the best questions are the ones that don't have immediate answers. So you know, you can't be defensive when you're trying to build a community and a purpose, and somebody asks you a question you don't have the answer. Sometimes the tendency is to, you know, to be defensive, and you really have to embrace the inquisitive mind and be open to ambiguity. But that's the default to yes, and then, you know, rationalize your way to a disposition that makes sense for the business and for the customer and the employee. But you do have to approach this transformation with a beginner's mindset. What I mean by that is you have to be open, you have to be interested, you know, free of prejudice, and I think if you're able to do that, and sometimes, David, you have to unlearn to learn the new, you know. So beginner's mindset, I think, is important in community building.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and one thing too that I think you're probably a little bit too modest to highlight, but I'll highlight is, you know, it's the personal example set by the executive leadership team every day. It's the example that you as CMO and CSO set, that the CEO sets, and so on, and that consistent behavior that people say, you know, our leaders are doing this, and you know, it works, and we should be doing this. So thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. We've just got done kind of the tip of the iceberg of all the really valuable lessons in social business excellence. So I hope everybody rushes out immediately and buys the book. It was one that I picked up really early on, and it was really a refreshing book and something I've learned a lot. Thanks so much, Bala.
Thank you very much, David. I really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you.